Hello, everyone. Welcome to A Little of This, A Little of That, a program dedicated to conversation, information, people, and places. Your host is Dan Dillman. I'm a retired academic looking for an audience. I hope you'll be a part of it. Each program, as you may well know, is a potpourri of items from several or all of the following categories meant to inform you, to entertain you, and once in a while to amuse you. The first item of business for today might be entitled Totally Bored. What we're going to do is talk about a new mountain tunnel in Switzerland and how it has been constructed. It's jacket weather outside, but miles inside the Swiss Alps, it's balmy, thanks to heat from the planet's core. Wearing a red hat, hard hat, and carrying a backpack with an emergency oxygen tank, you would be sweating as you got a rare look at the newest wonder of the world, a 35.4-mile base tunnel, the Gotthard Base Tunnel, now the longest tunnel on Earth. It's a $12 billion marvel that took 17 years to dig and will begin full operation on December 11th. For all their stark beauty, the Alps have always posed an obstacle to trains traveling between the North Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. Since 1892, the old 9.3-mile Gotthard Tunnel has had to suffice, but it is at more than 3,600 feet of elevation. It's a slow, if scenic, traverse of the mountains. Swiss citizens voted to go under the mountains in 1992, and 2,600 workers in round-the-clock shifts worked to accomplish this. Four massive boring machines, tabular mobile factories, each stretching the length of four football fields, gnawed out the twin tunnels, delving under a mile and a half of rock. Drill heads fitted with 58 17-inch rock-chomping steel roller cutters pushed against the stone with a 26-ton force, progressing at 130 feet or so each day. When the north and south tunnels finally met in the middle, after roughly 18 miles of drilling from either direction, they were only off about a few centimeters. Quite a job. And they were ahead of schedule, too. Almost all of the 28 million tons of excavated rock was reused, much of it to form the tunnel's concrete lining. And water drained from the tunnel will feed new aquaculture farms nearby. The Swiss Federal Railways will whisk up to 15,000 passengers per day through the tunnels at a speed of 155 miles per hour. This will cut the ride from Zurich to Milan, Italy, from 4 hours to three. But the real boon will be in moving goods through Europe. The tunnel can accommodate 260 cargo trains per day. That's four times as many as the nearest tunnel in use, and those trains can carry much greater loads. From Swiss chocolate to Italian cars. One result will be cleaner air. 40 million tons of freight will travel through the tunnel annually, shifting cargo hauled by 650,000 trucks each year from roads onto the rails. We didn't invent the railway, says Daniel Ackermann, a Federal Railways official, but now we Swiss are the best at building railroads. If you want to hear more or read more about this, you should look at the Smithsonian Magazine, November 2016. 16. And now, while we're at the Smithsonian Magazine, we want to have some questions and answers as people write into the Smithsonian Institution and ask the experts in various fields questions that they have in mind. The first one is from Anne Conley. She's in Portland, Oregon. Anne asks, my grandmother says letters from my grandfather in Chicago used to reach her in St. Louis in just one day. Was that really possible? And the answer to Anne was, it was not only possible, but very likely. From 1864 to 1977, inner-city mail was carried on trains and sorted by postal clerks en route for distribution to neighborhood post offices. And in big cities, mail was delivered multiple times a day. A letter leaving Chicago in the morning could very well be processed on the train, taken to the St. Louis post office, and delivered the same day. And then, a question from Kim Nofsinger in Scottsdale, Arizona. She wonders, why do experts keep saying World War II ended on August the 15th, 1945? When the Japanese surrendered, it was August the 14th here in the United States. And the answer to Kim was, historians usually record events based on the time and date where they occurred. The United States is 13 time zones behind Japan. It was August the 15th in Tokyo when Emperor Hirohito, having survived a coup attempt by militarists who wanted to prolong the war, announced the surrender via radio. But it was August the 14th in Washington when President Harry Truman made his announcement at a news conference. And then this third question. This comes from Sophia Hendricks, and she's from Ghent, Belgium, across the pond, huh? She asks, how many African American soldiers served in the American Revolution? How many served in the Civil War? And in all American wars combined? And the answer for Sophia is that African Americans have served in every American war. But pre-Civil War numbers are inexact. During the American Revolution, an estimated 5,000 to 6,000 black soldiers fought for the colonies, and an uncertain number fought for the British. During the Civil War, more than 179,000 served in the Union Army, and some 20,000 to 30,000 in the Union Navy. Estimates for earlier conflicts, such as the War of 1812, and the Mexican-American War are soft at best, so it would take a Herculean effort to come up with a precise total. Anyone bold enough to try might start with a National Archives database at archives.gov/research/military. And finally, this question from Alex Pappas in Brooklyn, New York. In How Data Won the West article in the July-August issue of Smithsonian, the author wrote that we've had maps for about 8,000 years. What were the first maps ever produced? Well, the answer to that is that there's no definitive answer, though scholars believe that there are candidates among several carvings on rocks, tusks, and bones that are more than 10,000 years old. Some see maps in the more primitive carvings, others only in the more complex ones. The extensive petroglyphs in and near Bellodina in the Italian Alps include perhaps the best-known ancient topographic map. They were carved over an 8,000-year period, ending about 1,000 B.C. And now our third item of the day is going to take us a little longer as I talk about the American-Mexican borderlands. It's been in the news quite a bit lately in the recent election. But the U.S.-Mexico borderlands was my principal research topic when I was in academia, from about 1964, when I first visited the area, until in the mid to late 1980s. So I wanted to tell you a bit about these borderlands. And as you look at a map, you see that the U.S.-Mexico border is in part a river and in part a straight line. So it has in part a geometric border and what we call a physiographic border or physical border. And as we look along this border, from San Diego, Tijuana, in the west, there are 15 pairs of border towns that are strung like beads on a necklace along the almost 2,000-mile length of the U.S.-Mexico border. The other border towns are in Calexico and Mexicali. Mexicali is in Baja California, in Mexico. Calexico is in California. And then as we cross the Columbia River, which for a very short distance carries the U.S.-Mexico border, we come to the twin communities of San Luis Rio Colorado on the Mexican side, and it is in the state of Sonora. On the Arizona side is the community of Somerton. As we travel east along the geometric boundary of Arizona and the Mexican state of Sonora, we come to Nogales, Arizona, and Nogales, Sonora, sometimes referred to in Spanish as Ambos Nogales, or both Nogales. Continuing on eastward along the straight line border, we come to two communities, one in Sonora. It is called Naco, N-A-C-O, and across from Naco is Naco, Arizona. And also to the east, a short distance, is Douglas, Arizona, and Agua Prieta in Sonora. Now we're going to cross into the Mexican state of Chihuahua, and we'll cross into the U.S. state of New Mexico. In New Mexico is the community of Columbus, and in Chihuahua, Mexico, is the community of Puerto Palomas. And finally, our straight line takes us to the Rio Grande, the river which is called the Rio Grande in the United States, and in Mexico, it's referred to as the Rio Bravo del Norte, because there's more than one Rio Bravo in Mexico. But here, where the straight line boundary meets the Rio Grande, or the Rio Bravo del Norte, we have El Paso, Texas, and in Chihuahua, the Mexican state, we have Ciudad Juarez. Continuing down the Rio Grande, where the Rio Grande carries the border from now until it empties into the Gulf of Mexico, we come to the twin communities of Presidio, Texas, and Ojinaga, Chihuahua. And now we make the Big Bend, where Big Bend National Park is located in the United States. And then the Rio Grande, or the Rio Bravo, turns northward. And on the Mexican side is the state of Coahuila. And there you find Ciudad Acuña, and across from it, across the Rio Grande in Texas, is Del Rio. Continuing on down the Rio Grande, or the Rio Bravo, we come to Piedras Negras, also in the state of Coahuila, but across in Texas is Eagle Pass. And continuing still more down the Rio Grande, we pass by very quickly the portion of the state of Nuevo León, which touches the river. But then very soon we are in the state of Tamaulipas. And it's here in Tamaulipas where we find the final pairs of the 15 pairs of border communities along the U.S.-Mexico border. First of all, Laredo, and in Mexico, Nuevo Laredo, often referred to as Los Dos Laredos. Continuing on down the river, we come to Roma in Texas, and in the state of Tamaulipas, it is Ciudad Miguel Alemán. Then onward to the twin cities of Reynosa in Mexico, the state of Tamaulipas, and across in Texas is the small community of Hidalgo. And finally, bringing this identification to an end, we have the towns of Brownsville in Texas and Matamoros in Mexico. And so, as I said to begin with, these are pairs of border communities strung along the necklace of the geometric border and the Rio Grande or Rio Bravo border of the U.S. And Mexico. These communities are very closely, they depend very much on each other, and they are so closely dependent upon one another, as if the Texas, let's say a Texas community sneezes, the Mexican community gets a cold. This very close relationship that they have economically and culturally and in many other ways is symbiotic. So the people who study the border area refer to the symbiosis of the border communities. But the borderline that I've described for you is not where the area begins. All you see is a line on the map. On one side is Anglo culture, on the other Mexican side is Hispanic culture. And one might think by looking at the map that there is a very abrupt end on either side with respect to culture change. But this is not true. Actually, the border is in the midst of a zone which is 100 miles wide, 50 miles or so on either side. And that zone is astride the border. You will begin to see changes as you get within 50 miles of the border on both the American side and on the Mexican side. So here in this border zone that is approximately 100 miles wide, a third culture has formed that is neither Anglo nor is it Hispanic. A third culture which is formed as the result of the blending or the fusion of two cultures to create a third culture. Scholars refer to this process as a syncretization, where this third culture has formed, and a different language is spoken in this border zone, as you well may know if you've gone there and know Spanish very well. You'll know that a knowledge of Spanish is not necessarily what is going to allow you to communicate well, because there is a border language in some places called Spanglish, Spanish and English. In another part of the border, it may be called Tex-Mex, Texan and Mexican Spanish. And so we have then an area which is not just a line on a map, but we have a borderlands area or region. Nothing really prepares you for the strangeness of the border experience. The first thing to know is that huge numbers of Mexican Americans and Mexican nationals cross the border every day and in both directions. We have here a border which is crossed 1 million times a day legally by people moving from one side to the other. There is no doubt that the U.S.-Mexico border is the world's busiest border. The people crossing have visas and passports or an ID that allows them access. Renting or buying a house on the U.S. side is prohibitive for many people. And so a whole cross-border culture has developed in which American citizens of Mexican descent live in a house or an apartment, or perhaps a simple shack, in a border city such as Juarez or Nuevo Laredo, and commute to their work each day in El Paso or Laredo. It's a fairly simple matter to walk to Mexico at any point, but there is always a crush of people, all of them with documents, waiting to enter the U.S., either to work, to go to school, or to buy clothes or electronics, which are much cheaper in the U.S. A busy bilingual Walmart is found on the U.S. side of most border crossings. There are always discount shops on the U.S. side, always discount pharmacies on the Mexican side. And now, the so-called boys' towns of former days, the red light districts for legal prostitution, see very little activity. There is a distinct border culture, as I've mentioned. And part of this border culture is the music, border music, which is not just narco-corridos or drug ballads celebrating the frontier exploits of the Mexican drug cartels, but what is called norteño music, the northern border ballads. A border vocabulary has grown up on both sides. And this is added to the complexity of this new zone, which not too many Americans really know that much about. I was thinking, as I've been talking to you today, that I should point out that in the pairs of twin cities along the border, it is usually the Mexican city or community, which is the larger of the two. So if you're, with the exception perhaps of the San Diego metropolitan area and the Tijuana metropolitan area, although Tijuana is one of the most populous cities in Mexico. That seems to be about as much as we can cover on the borderlands in this program. But in the next program, I'm going to return and give you a lot more information, and we will probably use the entire program for that. Now it seems appropriate to go out with Herb Alpert's Tijuana Brass, playing Tijuana Taxi.